Hello, welcome to the second section of recording. This is the prelude, which is written by William Wordsworth, the great among the romantics. The first chapter is introduction to William Wordsworth. It may be that his manly chant beside more dainty numbers seems erotic tune. It may be thought has burdened since he died upon the centuries known enough that there is none since risen who sings. A song so gotten of the immediate soul, so instant from the vital fount of things, which is our source and goal. This is written by William Wordsworth. Now I'm going to read the life and works of William Wordsworth. William Wordsworth, born in the year 1770 at Cockermouth. His boyhood was happy. He could roam among the fields of his beloved countryside in company with nature and the books he loved. Sent to St. John's College, Cambridge, 1787, but subsequently attracted by the hopes born of the French Revolution, lived for some while in France, returning in 1792. Subsequently settled down with his sister Dorothy Ann Coleridge at Alfoxden. But for the last 50 years of his life, lived first at Dove Cottage, Grasmere, and finally at Rathmount. He married in 1802, appointed to a sinecure office, bring in an income of $500 in a year. In 1813, he became the poet laureate and died in the year 1850. In 1798, he wrote a great poem named as Lyrical Ballads, which published in the magazine of Lyrical Ballads. This contained not only the noble Tintern Overlines, one of Wordsworth's novelist efforts, but also Coleridge's Ancient Mariner. In 1800, a second and enlarged edition of the book was published with a valuable preface containing an outline of his poetical theory. Among the new poems were Lucy, The Fountain, Matthew, Nutting, all characteristic of Wordsworth's genius. In 1807, poems in two volumes. This containing ballads, short poems, sonnets, the ode and the intimations of immortality, one of the very greatest poems of the country. The ode to duty and the happy warrior lines. In these two volumes, we have Wordsworth at the zenith of his powers. 1814, The Excursion, Wordsworth's longest poem, and it is largely autobiographical, full of discussion on man, on nature, and on human life. The Recluse, The Prelude were published after the poet's death. To this year belongs the fine classical study of Laodamia. 1820-35. Many of his sonnets were written during these years, but his magnificent patriotic sonnets belong to the period 1802-11. Main characteristics of Wordsworth's poetry. Wordsworth's treatment of nature. As a poet of nature, Wordsworth stands supreme. He is a worshipper of nature, nature's devotee of or high priest. Nature occupies in his poems a separate or independent status and is not treated in a casual or passing manner. Tintern Abbey is a poem with nature as its theme. Wordsworth pursues nature in a different form that of Pope. Unlike Pope, Wordsworth sincerely believed that in town life and its distraction, men had forgotten nature and they had been punished for it. Constant social intercourse had dissipated their energy and talents and impaired the susceptibility of their hearts to simple and pure impression. One of his sonnets is eloquent of this idea. The world is too much with us, late and soon, getting and spending, we waste our powers. Little we see in nature and that is ours. Wordsworth brings a new and intenser interest in nature. Pope looks at nature as objectively as possible. Naturally, his view is hardly colored by his hyper-individualism. It has been stated that the antithesis to Pope's idea of nature is hyper-individualism. Interestingly enough, Wordsworth's explorations of what nature had to say to him spring from his hyper-individualism. Thus, with Wordsworth's poetry of nature took in a new range, passing beyond sensuous presentation and description to vision and interpretation. Under the influence of nature, he experiences a mystic mood, a transcendental feeling. Four stages of Wordsworth's love of nature. First stage, he loved the outward appearance of nature, her grandeur in color and beauty. Her, from an external features like many other poets of his own and subsequent ages. And with the precision and the faithfulness of a lover, he described her from and experienced a childlike joy and experienced a childlike joy in simply describing the details of the features of nature with wonderful accuracy. The periwinkle trails its rays through primer stuffs. The celandine is muffled off in a closed self-shelter. The green linnet is a brother of a dancing leaves. The tuft of hazel trees twinkles to the gusty breeze. He heard the twofold song of a cuckoo. He saw the beauty of the moon that wears her bosom to the sea. Second stage. But the external feature of the land, the sea, the sky, the sun, and the moon were not at all the sources of joy to him. Wordsworth is one of the world's most loving, penetrative, and thoughtful poets of nature. He found much of his greater joy in the presence of her calm, her beauty, her external revelations of a divine hand. For nature possesses a soul, a conscious existence, an ability to feel joy and love. In the lines written in early spring, he says, "And this is my beauty, this is my faith, that every flower enjoys the air it breathes." In the immortality ode, he incorporates this belief in the lines, "The moon doth with delight look round her when the heavens are bare." Third stage. But what was more, he not only conceived that nature was alive, it had, he imagined, one living soul which, entering into flower, stream, or mountain, gave them each a soul of their own. Between the spirit in nature and the mind of man, there was a pre-announced harmony which enabled nature to communicate with its own thoughts to man and man to reflect upon them until an absolute union between them was established. And it was his belief that man makes himself miserable by tearing himself away from the heart of nature, by waging a foolish strife with nature. "But we are passed by heavy laws," the fountain. Fourth stage. This brooding communication with nature brought him much wealth of moral illustration, and this he communicated in poetic language for the benefit of the spiritual side in the human nature. The poet philosopher considered it a mission of his life to be teacher of mankind. Many of the smaller poems are written with the object of teaching mankind the truth that is subjective contemplation revealed to his own mind. Such are "The Leisure Canal Dine," "The Fountain," "Two April Mornings." Main aspects of Wordsworth in treatment of nature. Wordsworth had a complete philosophy of nature. Four points in his creed of nature may be noted. A. He conceived of nature as a living personality. He believed that there is a divine spirit persuading all the objects of nature. This belief finds a complete expression in Tintanabhi when it tells us that he has felt the presence of a sublime spirit in the setting sun, the round ocean, the living air, the blue sky, the mind of man, etc. This spirit, he says, rolls through all things. Emotion and a spirit that impels all thinking feels all objects of all thought and rolls through all things, the guide, the guardian of my heart and soul of my all moral being. This belief in a divine spirit pervading all the objects of nature is called pantheism. B. Next verse, we believe that the company of nature gives joy to the human heart. In Tintanabhi, he expresses the joy he feels on revisiting a scene of nature. Not only is the actual sight of this scene pleasing, the very memory of this scene has, in the past, soothed and comforted his mind. He gained sweet sensations from these objects of nature in hours of weariness. Nature has a healing influence on troubled minds, as he tells his sister. Valswat looked upon nature as exercising a healing influence on sorrow-stricken hearts. See, above all, Valswat emphasized the moral influence of nature. He spiritualized nature and regarded her as a great moral teacher, as the best mother, guardian, and nurse of man. As an elevating influence, he believed that between man and nature there is spiritual intercourse. According to him, nature deeply influences human character. In Tintanabhi, he tells his sister Dorothy that nature never did betray the heart that loved her, that nature can impress the human mind with quietness and beauty, that nature gives human beings lofty thoughts. He advises Dorothy to let the moon shine on her and the winds blow on her, to put herself under nature's influence. In his eyes, nature is a teacher which wisdom we can learn if we will, and without which any human life is vain and incomplete. He believed in the education of man by nature. In this, he was somewhat influenced by Rousseau. This interrelation of nature and man is very important in considering Wordsworth's view of both. In Tintanabhi, he also distinguishes his love for nature as a boy from his love for her as a man. As a boy, his love for nature was a physical passion, and as a grown-up man, his love for nature is intellectual or spiritual. As a boy, nature was an appetite with its aching joys and dizzy raptures. As a man, his love is thoughtful because of the still, sad music of humanity which he has heard. In the Immortality Ode also, he tells us that as a boy, his love for nature was a thoughtless passion, but now the objects of nature take a sober coloring from his eyes and give rise to profound thoughts in his mind because he had witnessed the suffering of humanity. To me, the meanest flower that blows can give thoughts that lie too deep for tears. D. Wordsworth's attitude to nature can be clearly differentiated from that of the other great poets of nature. He did not prefer the wild and stormy aspects of nature like Byron, or the shifting and changeful aspect of nature and the scenery of the sea and sky like Shelley, or the purely sensuous in nature like Keats. It was his special characteristic to concern himself not with the strange and remote aspects of the earth and sky, but nature in her ordinary, familiar, everyday moods. Nor did he recognize the ugly side of nature, nature red in tooth and claw, as Tennyson did. Wordsworth is to be distinguished from the other poets by the stress he places upon the moral influence of nature and the need of man's spiritual intercourse with her. Wordsworth's philosophical doctrine of nature. The philosophical content of the prelude is made up largely of Wordsworth's doctrine of nature, which is outlined and repeated in other poems also. Especially in Tintanabhi and Lucy's Education of Nature, it has been rightly pointed out the Wordsworth's philosophy of nature with its emphasis upon the divinity of nature. Wordsworth's philosophical doctrine of nature. The philosophical content of the prelude is made up largely of Wordsworth's doctrine of nature, which is outlined and repeated in other poems also, especially in the Tintern Abbey and Lucy's Education of Nature. It has been rightly pointed out the Wordsworthian philosophy of nature and with its emphasis upon the divinity of nature, nature's holy plan, the one life in the universe and in man, joy in the widest commonality spread, and nature as a source of wisdom and moral health, was derived from the current speculations of the day, to which poets, philosophers and scientists had contributed alike. Wordsworth took these tenets from the deep-rooted convictions of the day and gave them the authenticity of personal experience and the vitality of the poetic expression. Keats has rightly stated that conventional proverbs, precepts and dogmas of religion are the meaningless to us until they are tested on our pulse. Come home to our business and bosom and have become the formative influences in our moral and spiritual life. This is actually what Wordsworth has confessed in so many words and so many occasions. There is whatever little force in the observation of Arnold and others, including Morley and Raleigh, that the philosophy of doctrine of nature in the poetry of Wordsworth is an illusion. As a matter of fact, Wordsworth regarded himself with Coleridge as a philosophical poet and his philosophy according to his own confessions was a handout of his own experiences and entitled him to the position of the teacher of the society which he was anxious to achieve and maintain. The basic principle of this doctrine is the unity of man and nature and partakers in the one and the same life, which meant a preordained harmony between the two. Nature was animated by a soul which was the eternity of thought, wisdom, love, joy, the central peace substituting at the heart of endless agitation. Every object in nature was alive and full of joy and energy, substituting the imperfect love and concern and begging no strife with other objects, as an unfortunately the case with human individual and multitudes. Nature thus is best fitted for the position of man's teacher. She brings sweet love as contrasted with the bookish knowledge which an endless strife. Hence Wordsworth stresses the necessity of wise passiveness in attuning of the mind to the mood of nature, so that the whole scene may sink into it, or the mind may drink into influence like a child at the breast of the mother. Thus it follows that influences of the deeper worth are likely to come in solitude. Nature was both law and impulse, with powers to kindle and restrain, so that her beauty and fear were equally necessary for the growth of the poet's mind. The prelude in its early part is mostly occupied with the growth of the moral sense affected by nature's ministration of fear in the young poet. But as the story proceeds, the picture of changing pattern of relationship between the poet mind and nature is clearly unrolled. The four stages distinctly marked in Tintern Abbey are present. In the prelude also have been described by Professor Dowden as those of blood, senses, heart or imagination and spirit. The first is the stage of childhood, when he either bounded as a fawn on mind full of nature or received suggestions through fear inspired by her. The second stage covers boyhood and youth, when his heart awakened to the loveliness of nature and sounding cataracts haunted him like a passion, and the form and color of the objects absorbed his whole heart. But as he advanced in life and came face to face with the suffering of humanity, especially during his stay in France, the wild joys and giddy raptures of youth mingled with the melancholy note of experience. The still sad music of humanity, nor hearts, nor greeting, but with ample power of chasten and subdue. It is a being which pervades the universe as described in Tintern Abbey, in the grand but well-known passage, as something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of the setting sun and the wide ocean and the living air, and in the mind of man a spirit and motion which moves all thinking things and all objects of thought and rolls through all things. This was pantheism, the identification of God with nature, which was anti-Christian. As Wordsworth advanced in stage and his revolutionary fervor declined into the sober light of orthodoxy, he began to re-examine the early version of the Prelude, 1806, in order to make its doctrine more conformable to the Christian sentiment. The pantheistic passage in the Prelude, therefore, is immediately followed by verses which place God, the uncreated, above his, beyond his creation, so that the objects of nature are made to look up to him and sing to one song of thanks and glorification of his mercy and might. The final position reached the Prelude is a further modification of pantheism. Growth of mind means the growth of imagination, which is at once the amplitude of mind and reason in her most exalted mood as an aspect of love and intellectual sympathy of thought soaked in feeling. The great mind with its full-grown imagination faces nature, a reservoir of beauty, power, energy, and exquisite wedding of the two is productive of the best and greatest of poetry. This partnership between mind and nature is based upon mutual domination, which means that sometimes the mind can change and transfigure nature by its own energy and imagination. But on the other occasions, it is caught by the spontaneous beauty and grandeur on the face of nature as angels and caught by the higher harmony of heaven as they enter the celestial domain after their journey through the other regions in the sky. The difference of the transcendental philosophy finally adopted by Coleridge is quite apparent. In this philosophy, nature is made alive by the mind of man and the object becomes one with the object. It is a philosophic monism, while the Wordsworthian doctrine is based on dualism. The entities of mind and nature are wedded together but not fully identified, each retaining its separate strength to modify and color the other. Wordsworth's pantheism. The greatest contribution of Wordsworth to the poetry of nature is his unqualified pantheism. He believes that God shines through all the objects of nature, investing them with a celestial light, a light that never was on sea or land. He finds him in the shining of the stars. He marks him the flowering of the fields. The immense of the God in nature gives him mystic visions. Nature is no longer a mere vegetation subject to the law of growth and decay, not a collection of objects to be described, but a manifestation of God. Nature is a revelation, and Wordsworth is the prophet. Wordsworth came to believe that beneath the matter of the universe, there was a soul of living principle acting, even thinking. It may be living, at least speaking to him, communicating itself to him. In all things, in all natures, in the stars, which active principles abides from link to link, it circulates the soul of all the worlds. Wordsworth's mysticism. Auré Duvier speaks of Wordsworth as a mystic. Indeed, his mysticism is just as a fundamental and forbidding element in his poems, that it must be considered very carefully. Wordsworth believes that God pervades the entire universe, both animate and inanimate. It is in the thought of God that the universe exists, and its life is in God's thought. Not only that, the life in every flower, bird, insect, and the mossy stone of the hillside is part of divine life. As such, nature and every object in it has a life of its own, and it is even conscious of it. That is why Wordsworth, in all his moods of inspired ecstasy of or calm contemplation, is thrilled through and through with the sense of some inscrutable presence in nature to which the soul of a man is linked by some mysterious bond of connection. I have felt a presence that disturbs me with the joy of elevated thoughts, a sense sublime of something far more deeply interfused, whose dwelling is the light of setting suns, and the round ocean, and the living air, and the blue sky in the mind of man. Emotion and spirit that impels all thinking things, all objects of all thoughts, and rules through all things. Okay, then Wordsworth as a poet of man. Wordsworth was not only the poet of nature, he is also the poet of man. It is by his close and loving penetration into the realities and simplicities of human life that he himself makes his claim on our reverence as a poet. He relates in the prelude how he has been led through love of nature to honor man. The love of nature leads him to the love of man. In many of his poems, his efforts have been to show that the keynote of all life is to enjoy happiness. Happiness not as the result of chance or circumstances, but as sometimes to be owned by work, sacrifice, service or patience. He always chooses for his heroes and heroines, not famous men and women stupefied by victory or intoxicated with glory and power, but humble peasants, innocent farmers, artless shepherds, lonely reapers, and highland girls, and shows that in their commonplace carriers there is ample material to move the soul. Wordsworth's poetry of man can be considered in two ways: his poetry of man in relation of nature and his poetry of man in relation to human society. As a poet of village life, Wordsworth liked to represent simple village folk in natural setting and to describe how in the midst of their sorrows and wants they would be consoled by nature. He glorified village life because the villager lived so close to nature and communed with her daily. He found in the average villager a dignity, strength and courage and a sense of self-respect which he did not find among the town folk. As a poet of childhood, Wordsworth had his own peculiar way of looking at childhood. He was not much interested in the play of children, but he glorified childhood in the abstract. The beauty of children makes him galled, but he never rests there. He reads mysterious revelations in the child's innocence. Its fancies are brought from afar. It is the father of man, the seer hunted forever by the eternal mind. The root of this feeling was Wordsworth's memory of his own childhood, so ordinary in its incidents, so marvelous in its emotions. He regarded his mature imagination as a friendly following out the stress of this boyish vision. The child life is the hiding place of man's power, where man must seek with all its mature faculty. This thought is given a magnificent expression in his ode on the intimations of immortality. Return to nature and Wordsworth's Return to nature was Wordsworth's motto, and since he saw little distinction between the soul of nature and the uncorrupted, unsophisticated soul of man, nature as existing in the heart of man was an object of his close attention. He was a realist and dealt boldly with substantial things. It is by his close and loving penetration into the realities and simplicities of human life, and he himself makes his claim on our reverence as a poet. The love of nature led him to the love of man. It was exactly the reverse order to that of the previous poets. His interest in the simple by ordinary types of humanity is illustrated by his treatment of their simple joys and sorrows, their thoughts and afflictions, their general goodness and their daily interest. Simon Lee, Margaret, poor Swan, the schoolmaster Matthew, the highland girl, attracted him at isolated points of spiritual illumination. His interesting study and the mystic faith in the glories of childhood are but a natural corollary of his keen interest in his simplicities, virtues and goodness of uncorrupted humanity. His children are rarely tossed with the exquisite tenderness of Coleridge, but with a kind of solemn joy, fast often into mystic awe. He reads mysterious revelations in the child's innocence. His fancies are brought from afar. Its carols are fitted to unutterable thought. It is father of the man, the seer hunted forever by the eternal mind. The mystic conception of man. To this natural philosophy of man, Wordsworth adds a mystic element, the result of his own belief that in every natural object there is a reflection of the living God. Nature is everywhere, transfused and illuminated by spirit. Man also is a reflection of a divine spirit, and we shall never understand the emotions roused by a flower or a sunset until we learn that nature appeals through the eye of man to his spirit. In a word, nature must be spiritually discovered. In Tintanabe, the spiritual appeal of nature is expressed in almost every line. But the mystic conception of man is seen more clearly in Intimations of Immortality, which Emerson calls the high water mark of poetry in the 19th century. In this splendid ode, Wordsworth adds to his spiritual interpretations of nature and man the alluring doctrine of his pre-existence, which was appealed so powerfully to the Hindus and which makes of human life a continuous, immortal thing without end or beginning. Wordsworth's theory of poetic diction. In his preface to the second edition of the Lyrical Ballads, Wordsworth thus sets forth his aims. The principal object proposed in these poems was to choose incidents and situations from common life and to relate or describe them throughout in a selection of the language really used by men, and at the same time to throw over them a certain coloring of the imagination whereby ordinary things should be presented to the mind in an unusual aspect. He goes on to say that humble and rustic life was generally chosen because in that condition the essential passions of the heart find a better soil in which they can attain their maturity. Realism under restraint and speak a plainer and more emphatic language. In the above statement, we got some important points regarding Wordsworth's theory of poetic diction. Firstly, in the choice of subject or themes, Wordsworth goes straight common life and by preference to humble and rustic life. Secondly, Wordsworth describes his themes taken from humble and rustic life as far as possible in a selection of language actually used by ordinary men. He does not look with favor upon the pompous and stilted circumlocution of the 18th century writers who delighted using gutty language. Thirdly, Wordsworth says that while choosing his themes from the common and rustic life and describe them in the language of the common people, his object is to throw over them a certain coloring of the imagination whereby ordinary things should be presented to the mind in an unusual aspect. Wordsworth's theory of language and poetic diction. Wordsworth held certain theories of language and poetic diction which deeply influenced his work. He disliked intensely the artificial diction employed by the 18th century poets. Loving as he did nature and the simple ways of rustics who hardly communed with the beautiful objects of nature, he considered simple language to be a better medium for poetry than the conventional diction used by poets of the time. In his famous preface to the Lyrical Ballads, he enunciated his theories. He said that he was going to use a selection of the language really used by man, and this chiefly in humble and rustic life, and at the same time to throw over the incidents described a certain coloring of imagination. He also said that there neither is nor can be any essential difference between the language of prose and verse. Wordsworth occasionally violates his theory. In actual practice, when Wordsworth tried to imitate the simplicity of rustic speech, he produced some of his worst effects. In some of his poems, he cultivates simplicity of diction, no doubt, as it does in Solitary Reaper. But even in that poem, the diction is tossed with imagination so that we have suggestive lines. The diction of Immortality Ode and Tintanabe is not simple and doesn't come anywhere near the language of prose. In his practice, Wordsworth did not follow the theory of enunciated. His poetic instinct saved him from that blunder. However, it must be admitted that on the whole, Wordsworth is more simple in diction and more sparing in the use of imagery than the other romantic poets. Moral value of Wordsworth's poetry. Wordsworth's poetry is characterized by a restrained yet undaunted optimism. He holds that life, despite its manifold evils, is yet good and worth living. The evils themselves are stepping stones to good, Outward virtues are developed through suffering. Man is not alone in the world nor alone in his suffering, because God is always and everywhere present to protect and support him. Man can rise above his suffering by calling to his aid and own moral strength and the resources of divine providence. Faith in God and faith in a glorious human destiny, this is the solution of the problem of earthly life. It is a creed full of lofty spiritualism, and Wordsworth could justifiably claim that his poetry would cooperate with the vengeance tendencies of human nature in making man nobler, poorer, and better. Wordsworth, the teacher, a teacher or nothing. Wordsworth once said, "Every great poet is a teacher. I wish either to be considered as a teacher or as nothing." It appears, therefore, that Wordsworth wrote poetry more in order to teach than to answer the urge his poetic soul. But this is only one side of the truth about the poetical work of Wordsworth. Though his aim was to teach, yet he was preeminently a poet. He combines, as every poet does, the functions of a poet and a teacher. How does a poet teach? He teaches not by giving out moral precepts and maxims as a moralist or a theologian does. He teaches by presenting before the world a new vision of life. He sees beyond the surface things, and the truth which he perceives and realizes, he expresses his own way. Every great poet reveals a new aspect of which nobody else has found before. He discovers a new beauty, a new wonder in the common facts of life. He beholds it with joy and communicates it to the world. This new vision that the poet discloses, it is not only beautiful and glorious, but provides us to a new angle which to look at life. It is like clearing out our blurred sight, exciting our dull minds. And because of the poet speaks in the language of feeling, his poetry penetrates deep into our hearts and refines our feeling. He doesn't educate the mind so much as he elevates the soul. He does not teach as the schoolmaster does, but moves the springs of feeling and emotion, and thus raises the moral and spiritual level of mankind. Where Wordsworth consciously and deliberately teaches, his poetry flags and becomes dull and prosaic. Where he presents his vision of life, his teaching is most in his poetry, which thrills and inspires. Autobiographical element in Wordsworth's poetry. Every great poet expresses through his work his imaginative vision of life, and the equality of his poetry depends upon the depth and range of his vision. And this vision of the poet is the almost essential quality of himself. Apart from his vision, he is like any other man, and to this vision he gives a poetic vesture. This is his real and essential poetry. The three great poems which are distinctly and frankly autobiographical are lines composed about Tintin Abbey. The Prelude, 1799, and the Odes on the Intimations of Immortality, 1806. Besides these three poems, there are many other, like Matthew poems, Ode to Duty, Pill a Castle. Some sonnets are probably the Lucy poems, which have an autobiographical interest and reveal the mind and personality of the poet. Wordsworth is always subjective in his treatment of nature and man. His lyrics are all self-revealing, but there are some poems like those mentioned above in which the poet either describes his life and experiences or directly reveals some aspect of his personality. Defects of Wordsworth's poetry. The inequality of his production. Wordsworth's inspirations came in bursts. There are magnificent passages in his poetry, but at times one comes across such lines are as devoid of all inspiration. The poet who could write with a fine austere reserve, "She is dead, the light extinguished of her lonely heart, the heart itself abandoned to decay," could also perpetrate these lines about a grave. "I have measured it from side to side, it is 3 feet long and 2 feet wide." The poet who could pen such a line as, "The silence that is in the starry sky," could suffer this line without come. The silent events are going on. Prolixity. It cannot be denied that Wordsworth, the very highest powers of the poetic mind, were associated with a certain tendency to the diffuse and and the commonplace. Want of humor. Other limitations of Wordsworth's genius are that he had no humor and a little passion. He is singularly deficient in dramatic power, and his whole hatred and preoccupation with his own experiences is insensible to critical self-consciousness. Matter of factness. It lies in a laborious minuteness and fidelity in the representation of objects and their position and the insertion of accidental circumstances. This first appears superfluous in poetry, and the second goes against the very essence of poetry. Third, fondness of particulars. He had a fondness for particulars, and there are part of the poem which reminds us the local histories in the undue relative importance given to trivial matters. He was the historian of Wordsworth's sire. Thoughts and images too great for the subject. This is an approximation to what might be called mental bombast and distinguished from verbal. For as in the latter there is a disproportion of expression to the thoughts, so in this there is a disproportion of thoughts to the circumstances and occasion. Absence of love poetry. There is an element almost altogether wanting in Wordsworth, the absence of which forbids us to class him as a poet who has tossed all important sides of human life. The element of passionate love. A few of his poems, such as Barbara or in another kind of Laodamia, solemnly glide into it and retreat, but on the whole, this most universal subject of lyric poetry was not felt by Wordsworth. Stopper book. His one-sided ideal of humanity. The ideal human life, Wordsworth, is not hard-hearted, frugal, unambitious delesman of his own hills. With his strong affections, his simple taste, and his quiet and beautiful home, and this delesman built up by communion with nature and by meditation into the poet, philosopher with his serious faith and his never spring of enjoyment, is himself failing. But nature has many sided and lies under many lights. Abundance of nature, a gorgeous aspect. Herefore says the thunders of the Avalanche did not arrest him, but when the winter day was fading over the frozen lake, he had an ear for an alien sound of melancholy sent into the landscape from the distant hills. The glow and color of sunset again appealed to colorist or to Shelley. Wordsworth feels rather the melting depth of the sky or its blank loneliness or its silence. It is only the tranquil beauty of nature that appeals to the poet. The awful energies of the storm, the riot of the angry sea, and the blaze of conflagrant sunrise, or the demon dance of the thunder, have but little place in his poetry. Omission of nature, red in tooth and claw. Wordsworth celebrates the beauty, harmony, and sublimity of nature. He is fortified by the calm and unbroken order, the holy plan of nature. But nature is not all a mandate. She has a harsh and terrifying sight of which Wordsworth is apparently oblivious. He loses sight of nature, red in tooth and claw in with rapine. He is silent as to her mysterious discourse of pain, cruelty, and death. Nature is cruel and careless of the happiness of her millions of subjects. The scenes where the poet found pleasure and solace are a battlefield and slaughterhouse for other creatures. Fen and Fleer and Birdseye are a part of the law life. Thus, Wordsworth's eyes avert like the cane from half of human fate. It has been said to this extent his poetry of nature has been considered partial and incomplete. Chief excellences of Wordsworth's poetry. According to Coleridge, the following are the chief excellences of Wordsworth's poetry. I, an austere purity of language, both grammatical and logical. In short, a perfect appropriateness of the words to the meaning. A correspondent weight and sanity of thoughts and sentiments own, not from books, but from the poet's own meditative observation. Third, the naive strength and originality of single lines and paragraphs. Fourth, his perfect truth of nature in his images and descriptions. B, the meditative pathos, a union of deep and subtle thoughts with sensibility, a sympathy with man as a man, the sympathy indeed of a contemplator rather than fellow sufferer. Lastly, he has the gift of imagination in the highest and strictest sense of the word. In imaginative power, he stands nearest of all modern writers to Shakespeare and Milton. He brings indeed to all thoughts and to all objects the gleam, the light that never was on the sea or land, the consecration and the poet's dream. Conclusion. What is the cumulative effects of Wordsworth verse? What is its dominant note? It is not ecstatic, not gay, not tragic, but it is profoundly restful and restorative. Wordsworth's poetry has a soothing and a tranquilizing effect on the soul of man. J.S. Mill, distracted by the political problems of the day, tuned to him with infinite relief. I felt myself, he says, at once better and happier as I came under their influence. Many have been the sick minds since Mill's time on whom the medicine of Wordsworth's poetry has wrought a like change. Wordsworth purifies our heart by breathing into us sweet influence of nature. He appeals directly to our will and conduct. He heals the heart of those that approach him with a reverent and appreciating attitude. He is the poet of silence and solitude and can only be enjoyed in silence. Wordsworth sets forth before us the supreme purpose of his poetry in a letter that he wrote to Lady Beaumont to console and afflicted to our sunshine to delight by making the happy happier, to teach the young and the precious of every age to seek, to think, to feel, and therefore to become more actively and securely virtuous. Every great poet is a teacher, said Wordsworth. I wish to be considered as a teacher or as nothing, but is not a dull moralist. He is an inspired thinker who has given us a glimpse of truth that wake to perish never. Morley writes, what Wordsworth does is to assuage, to reconcile, to fortify. He has not Shakespeare's richness and vast compass, nor Milton's sublime and unflagging strength, nor Dante's severe, vivid and ardent force of vision. But he possesses the skill to lead us into the inner moods of settled peace, to touch the depth and not the tumult of the soul, to give us quietness, steadfastness, strength and purpose, whether to do or to endure.